Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Jonathan Jones reporting. The United Nations General Assembly will meet in a rare emergency session Thursday. The Council will be, the Assembly, that is, will consider invalidating U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital. The UN's Palestinian envoy, Riyad Mansour, asked for the meeting. The delegates will take up the same Egyptian draft resolution that the U.S. vetoed in the Security Council on Monday. The resolution in the General Assembly is non-binding, but a vote for or against a draft can have a lot of political consequences. On Tuesday, the U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley tweeted, "When we make a decision about where to locate our embassy, we don't expect those we've helped to target us. On Thursday, there'll be a vote criticizing our choice. The U.S., she warned, will be taking names." The government is accusing North Korea of launching a crippling cyber attack that affected hundreds of thousands of computers across the globe earlier this year. This is U.S. Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert.
After careful investigation, the United States is publicly attributing the massive WannaCry cyber attack to North Korea. We do not make this allegation lightly. We do so with evidence, and we do so with partners. Other governments and private companies agree. The United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and Japan have seen our analysis, and they join us in denouncing North Korea for WannaCry. Commercial partners have also acted. Microsoft traced the attack to cyber affiliates of North Korean government, and others in the security community have contributed their analysis.
Tom Bossert spoke Tuesday to reporters during a briefing at the White House. This is VOA News. The United States asked the United Nations on Tuesday to blacklist 10 ships that carried banned items from North Korea. The vessels, said the proposal, conducted illegal ship-to-ship transfers of refined petroleum products to North Korean vessels or illegally transported North Korean coal to other countries for exports. If none of the UN's 15 Security Council member states reject the proposal by Thursday, it will be approved. That means that all countries will be required to ban the blacklisted ships from entering their ports. Debate on age limits and term length for the president of Uganda came to a sudden halt Tuesday when a lawmaker reported seeing soldiers on the premises. The allegation led to a scuffle between legislators and parliamentary police. As correspondent Halima Athumani reports from Kampala, Parliament was already on edge because of the proposals being discussed.
The Ugandan Parliament is debating a bill that would abolish the age limit of 75 for presidential candidates, a move that would enable longtime president Yoweri Museveni to run for another term in the 2021 election. Opposition lawmakers and some members of the ruling party object to the bill, and debate that began Monday has been tumultuous. On Monday, shouting and heckling forced Speaker Rebecca Kadaga to suspend six members of parliament. Business came to a standstill again Tuesday after legislator Doris Okol told colleagues she had seen soldiers in parliament's Catholic chapel.
For me, I am shocked. I am really, really shocked. When I got there, both the Catholic and the Anglican chaplaincies were occupied by soldiers. They were eating from there. They have disorganized the whole place.
Members of the opposition, many wearing or holding rosary beads, then tried to enter the chapels but instead engaged in a scuffle with security officers who blocked them.
All these plates, cups, they are in our church, a Catholic church, where we are praying from. These soldiers, what do they want?
Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
A man convicted of plotting to kill Americans on behalf of the Islamic State has been sentenced to 28 years in prison. 28-year-old David Wright, who was found guilty in October of five criminal charges, reportedly planned with his uncle and a friend to travel to New York to attempt to behead conservative blogger Pamela Geller, who angered Muslims by organizing a Prophet Muhammad cartoon contest. Prosecutors and Geller wanted Wright to get life in prison. Defense team asked for 16 years. There's more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Jonathan Jones reporting from the world headquarters of the Voice of America in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The East African Community Legislative Assembly has elected a new speaker.
I'm glad that we are able to conclude this election. I thank my colleagues, the members of the 4th East African Legislative Assembly, who have bestowed on me the trust to be their speaker.
That's the new speaker of the East African Legislative Assembly. Cameroon migrants return home after a horrific journey. We'll examine the contribution tobacco continues to make to Zimbabwe's economy. And a high-level forum to revive South Sudan's 2015 peace agreement is underway in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa.
We call for the armed group that at least kindly, for the sake of the life of the citizens of South Sudan, from today, at least within the week, declares a state of hostility.
That's Edmond Yakani of the South Sudan Community Empowerment Network. Drinking coffee may prolong your life and is the foundation for a smoke-free world, acting as a smokescreen for big tobacco. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. After failing on Monday to elect the next speaker, the East African Legislative Assembly, meeting in Arusha, Tanzania, yesterday elected Rwanda's former Attorney General, Martin Ngoga, as its fourth speaker. But as Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha, the election has left the East African Legislative Assembly divided.
The much-contested speakership position of the East African Legislative Assembly finally ended as Rwanda's Martin Ngoga won the controversial elections. This comes after the assembly adjourned the plenary for 24 hours after Burundi and Tanzania had walked out of the parliament. Burundi said that it was its turn to take over the position and called on the heads of state to clarify on the rules of rotation, since Burundi and Rwanda joined the East African Community at the same time. The East African Community Secretary General Libera Mfumukeko said that it was vital for the region to remain united.
Consensus is very important. As you know, in all our organs, when we have council meetings, when we have any meetings, we seek for consensus, because the East African Community is a long-term project on which we all have to agree. I don't think it is a good idea to start with a divided assembly.
Regardless, Burundi and Tanzania's move to boycott the elections, Uganda, Kenya, Rwanda and South Sudan proceeded to vote for the speaker. Susan Nakauchi, a legislator from Uganda, said that assembly would not be affected by the controversial elections.
Different members from different banner states have always used the walkout as a ground to frustrate business of the assembly. If anything is on the assembly and they feel it's not in their own interests or it doesn't push the agenda, they always move out. So this is not going to affect the operation of the assembly. We shall come, we can suspend the rule of quorum and go ahead.
After taking the oath, the East African Legislative Assembly newly elected speaker, Martin Ngoga, said that he will abide by the rules of the community.
So I'm glad that we are able to conclude this election. I thank my colleagues, the members of the 4th East African Legislative Assembly, who have bestowed on me the trust to be their speaker. In my job, I will be guided by the treaty, I will be guided by the rules that govern the operations of our assembly.
The East African Legislative Assembly speaker is expected to serve 5 years until 2022. However, the challenge lies ahead as the community remained divided amid deteriorating relations between Burundi and Rwanda since 2015. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
More than 100 members of various groups meeting in Addis Ababa have agreed that a permanent ceasefire will create a favorable environment for tackling the issues that have hindered implementation of the 2015 peace agreement in South Sudan. John Tanza reports for VOA from Addis Ababa.
Members of the different armed and unarmed groups met at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa to discuss a draft ceasefire agreement to be signed by all parties on Friday. Civil society groups at the forum are calling on the warring parties to silence the guns immediately. As talks get underway in earnest, Clashes are being reported between government forces and rebels loyal to Riek Machar in Lasso, Kajukeji in Yei River State, and Lol State. Edmond Nyakani works for the Community Empowerment Network. He says the warring parties are preparing to gain some areas on the ground before signing a permanent ceasefire.
We're heading to dry season, and dry season is an apartheid season, very fluid season for the armed groups to confront themselves. And that's why with this particular point, we call for the armed group that at least kindly, for the sake of the life of the citizens of South Sudan, from today, at least within the week, declares a state of hostility.
Ismail Wallis is IGAD's special envoy for South Sudan. Wallis is facilitating the discussions on a draft ceasefire agreement to be signed by the warring parties on Friday at the end of the forum. The media is not allowed to attend the discussions. The widow of South Sudan's founding father, John Garang, gave an emotional speech at the official launch of the forum. Nyandeng urged participants to negotiate in good faith, saying time has come for South Sudanese to make compromises and end fighting in their country.
The way forward is for this government in Juba to go, because there is nothing that they can deliver and they will never change. Dr. John used to say that the government in Khartoum is too deformed to be reformed. It is this government in Juba who is too deformed to be reformed.
Nyandeng, who was once a minister of roads and President Kiir's advisor on gender, had no kind words for the Kiir administration.
We want this government to be replaced by the government of technocrats. If you are afraid to say it, I'm saying it. It's because there's nothing they're delivering. 3 weeks ago, 100 people died. How many people do we need to die in order for us to see this government is not delivering?
South Sudanese gender activist Rita Lopidia says the fighting has especially taken its toll on women and girls. She says armed and unarmed opposition groups must do more to stop the killings.
The suffering of women and girls in the Republic of South Sudan and those in refugee camps has surpassed all levels of carnage. The massive displacement, the sexual violence committed with impunity must not be tolerated and condoned.
Civil society leaders at the talks are expressing fear. The government delegation is trying to lock civil society groups out of the ongoing discussions on a permanent ceasefire. The atmosphere at the talks is tense, with various warring parties holding side meetings to discuss specific parts of the ceasefire document, such as access to humanitarian agencies operating in South Sudan. Various South Sudanese stakeholders are expected to sign a ceasefire agreement on Friday. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa.
At least 2 civilians were killed and 3 aid workers abducted after an attack on Sunday in South Sudan's Lol State. Solidarity International is demanding the unconditional release of its staff. The SPLA-IO rebels deputy spokesman confirmed rebel forces are holding 4 aid workers. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
At least 6 aid workers are said to be missing in Lol State following an attack by rebel forces loyal to Riek Machar on a convoy traveling from Wau to Raja last week. Alexander Groud, chief executive officer of Solidarity International, says one driver and 2 other staff members of his organization are still missing. SPLA-IO deputy military spokesman Colonel Lampaul Gabriel claims his forces are holding 4 aid workers. Gabriel says his forces ambushed a convoy traveling from Wau to Raja, claiming the convoy was transporting ammunition belonging to a government militia leader called Abderrahman Abrab.
We ambushed that convoy, and it was a heavy one. We destroyed 2 vehicles and killed a number of them, almost 35, and injured several. In the process, there were some civilians seen, and they were running in disarray. So we collected those civilians, including a white man. So they are with us at the moment.
Gabriel claims his forces took the 8 workers to protect them from being harmed during the clashes.
We are waiting for any third party organization that is neutral to come. We will hand them over without any condition, without they're just there for their safety. We can't hand them to the government, that will not work. But we'll hand them to a third party organization. Maybe ICRC can come and contact us
We'll give them back their people.
Lol State Governor Ruizik Zakaria says the rebels attacked commercial vehicles traveling from Wau to Raja, but denied it was an attack on a militia convoy. He says 5 civilians were killed and 4 vehicles were destroyed. Zakaria says the rebels also took a number of hostages working for 2 different organizations.
The rebels, the attackers, the assailants, they took these personnel as hostages, them, the 7 of them. 3 from HealthNet and 4 from Solidarity International.
SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwang denies Gabriel's claims and says there was no fighting between government and rebel forces during Sunday's attack on the convoy. He claims the rebels took 10 people hostage after the attack.
10 people were abducted, including members of the staff of Solidarity International, and primary reports have indicated that one of them was a white person whose nationality is yet to be established.
The UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Alan Nadau, released a statement expressing concerns over the whereabouts of the missing 8 workers. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Today's Wednesday, December 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. More than 700 Cameroon migrants who were stranded in Libya have been brought back home by the International Organization for Migration. The migrants say they were seeking greener pastures in North Africa and Europe. Instead, they were robbed by gangs, arrested, and often forced into slavery. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more from Yaoundé.
These hundreds of youths are protesting what they call the slavery their peers endured in North Africa and are calling for the African Union to locate and punish those who allowed the migrants to be exploited. The protest took place Tuesday as a group of migrants landed at Yaoundé Nsimalen International Airport. The migrants look exhausted and disheveled as they disembark from the chartered plane. Doctors are on hand to provide health screening and medical care, and psychologists try to help the migrants deal with the horrors they experienced. Psychologist Emmanuel Fe says most of the migrants were assaulted sexually.
Most of the women were raped, and even the men, they were raped. They are actually traumatized. So we meet them, we try to talk to them, and then we exchange with them and know their experiences. So from those experiences, we give them advice, necessary advice, to reboost their morals so that they are reinserted into their families, they are accepted back into their countries, and then they can continue their lives normally.
27-year-old Charles Tata is returning to the country he had wanted to leave at all costs due to hardship and joblessness. Unfortunately, he was arrested in Libya and subjected to indefinite detention in the Abdus Salam Detention Center in Tripoli. Tata describes his experience in Libya as 11 months of hell.
I was going to Italy. The boat that we were inside burst. We were on top of the water for 2 hours, 30 minutes without any rescue. People die in Libya because in Libya, everywhere is gone. They don't value blacks. If they saw you along the way, they just kidnap you and go and sell you to an Arab man.
Tata says he was released from prison when the UN Refugee Agency intervened, but he was taken to the town of Derna, where he worked on a cereal plantation for 2 months without pay. The IMO's Roger Charles Evina says his organization partnered with the government of Cameroon to bring back more than 700 migrants who volunteered to return.
Je voudrais d'abord remercier le gouvernement pour leur active participation. C'est très important parce que ça donne.
He says the migrants will be given $150 each to enable them buy food and gifts for their children, spouses and relatives who had been expecting much from them since they left, thinking that they will bring many things from their adventure. Cameroon says 120,000 of its citizens are illegal migrants. The country has created plans to give youths up to $5,000 to invest in agriculture and craftsmanship in hopes of convincing some of the migrants to return. Moki Edwin Kinzeka For VOA News, Yaoundé.
The new Zimbabwe government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa is putting together ideas on how to revive the country's sluggish economy. Tobacco remains one of the country's most lucrative cash crops, bringing in much-needed foreign currency. As Kuzvai Zvanavashi reports from Harare, Zimbabwe tobacco farmers are preparing for yet another growing season.
Ishewune Sumoyo is the Tobacco Industry Marketing Board spokesperson. He says tobacco exports brought in nearly $1 billion this year, and that was from a smaller than expected harvest.
The 2017 marketing season, there was a slight decline in the tobacco that was sold at the floors, largely because of the rains. The weight of the tobacco was lighter, and as a result of that, we didn't reach the 202 million kgs that we reached the previous season.
Moyo says farmers are working to have a better tobacco harvest next season.
Going forward, we have come up with a tobacco input credit scheme for farmers that are not contracted. This scheme is giving farmers fertilizers, chemicals, and we've got about 28.5 million that has been availed by the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe.
He adds farmers can also borrow from Agribank to pay for labor and other expenses such as coal for curing the tobacco. As a result, he expects more farmers will plant tobacco.
The registrations for this season are higher than the previous season. At the same time, soon after the sales, they would register for the forthcoming season. So as of now, we have registered 100,000 farmers for this coming season, which is an increase of about 20% from last season.
Moyo credits the increase of tobacco's higher value compared with other crops. In addition, this year, the government raised the farmers' export incentive payment to 12.5% of the sales price, up from 5%. But tobacco farming has its critics. In the past, environmentalists have complained that tobacco farmers cut down trees to cure the leaves before taking their crops to auction. The Tobacco Industry Marketing Board has been working on long-term solutions.
We also have initiatives such as we're exploring curing tobacco this season using solar energy. We've got this project at Chinoy University and the Tobacco Research Board. We're trying to explore alternatives so that we can try and conserve our woodlots because, as you realize, we want to produce tobacco in a sustainable manner.
To complement these efforts, the Tobacco Board has set aside a fund to plant trees around the provinces. The cash crisis that hit the country last year pushed farmers to make the uncomfortable shift from cash to plastic money. Moyo says they have adjusted and being in the banking system has helped them get loans. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvanavashe from Harare.
We have heard it before. Now, new research confirms that coffee is a healthy drink, but some of the other habits associated with the ritual of drinking coffee are not. VOA's George Putish reports.
Perhaps the best demonstration of coffee's impact worldwide happened recently in Beijing, the capital of tea-drinking China, where the US-based chain Starbucks opened its largest shop, taking up 2,700 square meters and employing more than 400 people. While the shop's popularity is not just for coffee's health benefits, a new study says they are indisputable.
There are some headline benefits, such as a lower risk of dying from any cause, a lower risk of dying from heart disease and stroke, and a lower risk of developing heart disease in the first place. And for those outcomes, the maximum benefit was around 3 to 4 cups of coffee per day.
Analyzing results of 201 previous studies about coffee's impact, researchers at the University of Southampton's Faculty of Medicine found that drinking coffee also lowers the risk of developing diabetes, liver disease, dementia, and even some cancers. The only exception was for pregnant women or those who are prone to bone fractures. But scientists point out the research was only about coffee, not what goes along with it.
It's not about the sugar and the syrups and the biscuits, cakes and pastries. And we'd urge people who are already drinking moderate amounts of coffee, about 3 or 4 cups per day mark, to enjoy it, but try and make it as healthy as possible, because standard health messages still apply to those other things.
The greatest benefit was in fighting liver diseases, so researchers are planning a clinical test of using coffee as a treatment for cirrhosis. But for some coffee lovers, there may be another circumstance that carries additional benefits: drinking coffee with pets around.
Pets are not only good for our health, but they can be good for our wealth, particularly if you have them in a small business environment where customers are going to be drawn in to interact with the dog or come in, and it's a really good icebreaker.
Private coffee shop owners take note. Having a pet in your cafe may benefit your business as well as your customers. George Putich, VOA News.
Critics accuse a new non-profit organization, the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World, of acting as a smokescreen for Big Tobacco, a charge vigorously denied by the foundation's president. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the controversy swirling around this new venture, which is being subsidized by a billion-dollar grant from tobacco giant Philip Morris.
The president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World, Derek Yak, was one of the architects of the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. He says the convention is successful in preventing people from smoking and in slowing the increase of smoking in children. But he says it focuses little attention on trying to get the world's billion smokers to quit the deadly habit.
To actually accelerate a decline in the billion smokers, we needed to have better cessation, harm reduction, and better product regulation. And I think those elements, I don't think, have got the energy that we actually require.
Yak says more than 7 million people globally die prematurely each year from tobacco. He tells VOA the foundation's mission is to wean smokers away from their addiction by using new harm reduction tools such as e-cigarettes and vaping. Philip Morris International plans to contribute about $80 million a year to the foundation over the next 12 years. Yak assures VOA stringent safeguards are in place to insulate his foundation from the influence of the tobacco industry. Philip Morris is a producer of an e-cigarette-type product. Vice President of Communications at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Vince Wilmore, tells VOA the alliance between the foundation and Philip Morris has no credibility.
This foundation is really a smokescreen designed to promote Philip Morris's business interest and to undermine real efforts to reduce the death and disease caused by tobacco use around the world. It's hard to take Philip Morris seriously that they want a smoke-free world when they're marketing cigarettes as aggressively as ever, and they're fighting real solutions to reduce smoking.
The World Health Organization also calls into question the work of the foundation. It notes that the number of clear conflicts of interest involved with a tobacco company funding a purported health foundation is evident. In a statement, WHO says it will not partner with the foundation and urges governments and the public health community to disassociate themselves as well. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A high-level forum to revive South Sudan's 2015 peace agreement is underway in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and the stakes could not be higher. The internal conflict that began 4 years ago has driven 2 million people from the country and left more than a million others a step away from famine, according to the United Nations. And that's it for this Wednesday, December 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a good day.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.